Hello and welcome to another edition of Center Circle Live. Marnie Thompson, Armin Badakian, Charlie O'Connor Clark is missing.
Yeah, and in his absence, we've got a new member of CPL Editorial, Holly Williams. Holly, say hi to everybody.
Hi, everybody.
Holly is interning with us over at CPL, and she's going to be taking over for Charlie in the next couple episodes of the podcast. We're also going to have some exciting guests over the next few weeks, so stay tuned for that. But Holly, we're unfortunate to have to bring this up, but I heard you're a Manchester United fan?
I am. Yeah, it is pretty unfortunate at this moment in time, but... not as unfortunate as it is to be a Chelsea fan.
Oh, my goodness. Come on.
Chelsea Man United was like, what, like 8 years ago?
Yeah, both of us were like relevant.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. So as you can tell, I'm still very bitter about losing Eden Hazard. I probably will not ever get over it, but it's fine. We have plenty of CPL action to talk about, which is a good little distraction. We had a big weekend. Actually, we had a big midweek and a big weekend, both for Cavalry FC and for Forge FC. Let's get right into it. I mean, that big spring decider, Marty, I mean, it was supposed to go one way, didn't go that way. That's just soccer though, isn't it?
Forge 1, Cavalry 0 at Spruce Meadows. I would like to point out that that Armin, myself, and Charlie all predicted Forge to win last week.
Yeah, we did.
Which, you know, I wouldn't...
Permutations, baby.
When I did, I was like, oh, that was maybe a bad idea. But Kyle Becker, in the fifth minute, beautiful left-footed goal. And that was their only shot on target the whole match.
Yeah, I think so. How many shots did they have in total?
They actually only had five shots.
Yeah, five shots in total. Like, you take advantage of your opportunities if you're Forge FC. And Becker said it even before the game. He was like, the pressure's not on us. The pressure's on them. They are the ones who need the win. All we have to do is keep doing what we're doing. And you know what? If you're Cavalry, you're coming into this perfect, and you're leaving it not so perfect anymore.
Yeah, and you saw Forge kind of change their normal game plan. Like, they didn't have the ball nearly as much as normal and, you know, kind of maybe invited a little bit more of that Cavalry pressure, especially playing at home, or playing away, rather.
Oh, yeah, totally. And that's the other thing is, when you're playing a team like Cavalry, for Forge, you guys have played them now three times in a row, so you learn and you adjust and you adapt and you figure out new ways of getting that result you want, and in this case, that you need. So it was a good testament to Bobby Smyrniotis, I think. He definitely planned it out correctly. He was smart to play Zajac. I think having him up top was a good kind of body, that exactly what you wanted from an Anthony Novak who wasn't available. So I think they got their game plan right. That being said, I mean, not the best attacking performance we've seen from them. They were limited to just five shots, as Holly pointed out, and it's just a matter of capitalizing. That's what they did.
And putting Kwame Awuah back at left fullback, that was obviously led to the goal.
Yeah.
But his pace is incredible for a defender.
Yeah, plus you're trying to neutralize Nico Pasquati, who's been like the number one guy for Cavalry when it comes to attacking output. But like, even Sergio Camargo, I think Elamane Cisse did a good job of keeping wraps on him. So they hit Cavalry where it hurt, and ultimately it didn't seem like Cavalry had as much of a foothold on this game as they usually do. So it's a result for Forge. It's definitely a positive.
So Forge, it was a must win, quite literally. If Cavalry got a draw, they would take the spring title there at Spruce Meadows. But that really changes things now, because Forge, you know, get that lifeline, and now they need to win on Wednesday against Edmonton to keep the dream alive. This loss, though, you mentioned it, Armin, off mic, but maybe a little bit of a mental block for Cavalry. I mean, you had a chance to win it at home, your only chance to win it at home, and... you blew it.
Yeah, I don't think they blew it. I think it was inevitable that they would lose eventually. I don't think they were going to go perfect in the spring. It's just, there's too much parity in this league anyways. And Cavalry were lucky on a couple occasions to get the breaks that they did. So I think it was a matter of time, really, until we saw a result like this. It's unfortunate that it happened at home when they really had an opportunity to wrap things up. But you know what? I mean, it's literally a case of Forge had no other option but to force this situation.
Yeah.
So I think that's really what it is. It's one team wanted it more. Becker said it after the match. He was like, well, we know that Cavalry will probably pick up another 3 points in one of their next two games, so it's not really done yet. But at the same time, Forge just did what they had to do.
Seven straight wins for Forge, which is, you know, once you really think about it, it was back to the HFX loss 2-1 on May 4th. That was the last time that they lost in the league.
Plus, Holly, you know, like Arsenal, their invincible season, how rare that was. So this is not common, right?
No, not at all. We, in all sports, we never see a team really go undefeated or have a very long streak of winning. Eventually, it has to come to an end. And
yeah, and it, but in a new league, though, I think that was what people were really keen to see, because they thought, well, if all these kind of teams are assembled in sort of this randomized way, maybe there is one way that they could do it. But you know, as they showed in the Canadian Championship too, they have faults.
Another interesting thing is that this is Tommy's first loss at home since 2015.
Wow.
Yeah. Back to the PDL, right?
Yeah, I think that was like against Seattle or something I heard on the broadcast. But yeah, that's a really good point. Like, this has been a long time coming for Tommy too. And, you know, records are for the statisticians is what he said at the end of the game. But it is fun to kind of look back and be like, wow, damn, that was kind of a long run.
Shifting focus here to Cavalry's El Clasico nemesis in FC Edmonton. We're recording this on Monday, so Sunday they took on Pacific FC and won 3-1. Their first goal in 500-something minutes, their first win in 50 days.
Yeah, 587, I think, was the final number, 587 minutes. So that is a long time to go without scoring a goal. It's not quite as, you know, drastic a situation, because I think a lot of teams were already out of the spring contention by this point, but you definitely don't like to see it. The interesting thing, though, was after the game, Jeff Paulus gave an interesting reason for why that change occurred, why they scored three goals. He said that they had a chance to sit down and look at the game tape, and they saw that they weren't necessarily shooting from the best positions. They compared their players and their previous matches to some European matches against, like, kind of compared against teams that shoot a lot, score a lot from open play. And what they found was that they were just making the wrong decisions. They were sending in crosses when they should have been taking shots, maybe too many crosses. That's, I guess, the logic of the service would be to try to get Tomi Amiobi as many looks as possible, but they were scoopering opportunities. So it came down to, how do we maximize our output? And what they ended up doing was just shooting more, and it worked.
Well, that Amiobi goal, I loved it, because, you know, the service from Soria was great, but the way that he was able to shield the ball and give himself a chance to make an easy finish out of something that otherwise would be very difficult, I thought showed a little bit more of his veteran leadership.
What do you guys think? Should you opt to shoot a ball more and be selfish, or is it a case of, if you can distribute and get a cross out, do that instead?
I would think distributing. You know, I'm a big fan of playing out wide, distributing out wide, and then crossing it in. But at the same time, you got to shoot your shot.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's always those periods of times where you're calling for a player to either pass, and he just goes for it and shoots himself. And you're like, if it's a goal, you're like, okay, don't pass.
Yeah,
obviously,
exactly.
It's not a goal.
Do your
you're
thing.
Like, you should have passed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they were, it was just a lot different. It was just a lot different from FC Edmonton, and obviously it worked, right?
Yeah, I would be super selfish, but that's just me.
And how about that Victor Blasco goal for Pacific?
Speaking
right at
of
the
selfish,
end?
Damn,
oh my
that
goodness.
Was a good one.
run from his own half, the confidence to keep the ball and look into space. You saw that he kind of like hesitated, but then just said, no, I'm going to go for it.
Wayne Rooney-esque. Back when he could do that, right?
Yeah, when he could do that.
Love the EPL chat here. And finally, York 9, 2-0 results. You know, maybe that isn't as glamorous as a headline, but they did finish third on our Center Circle Live power rankings this
week.
Yeah,
before we get into that, I should apologize to Wayne Rooney. He is still scoring plenty of goals for DC United. So. But yeah, York 9.
Sorry, I moved on from that too early. But
York 9, now third in our power rankings. And I think it's because what we're seeing from them in midfield is unprecedented. We're seeing a level of cohesion and kind of instinctual passing that I think we predicted a while back, and it's starting to bear fruit. The talent that Jimmy Brennan has in his team on paper, I think, is where the optimism comes from. But it's now a matter of converting whatever connections are being made into goals. And that takes a lot of time. That's really what it is. You just need to be patient. What I've seen from York 9 that encourages me the most is that players who should be selfish, speaking of selflessness and selfishness, players who have the right to be selfish are instead opting to keep the ball on the ground, pass it around a little bit more, cause some confusion amongst their opposition. And really, I mean, once they find the key to unlocking back lines with some sort of regularity, I think what we're going to find is a team that's not going to struggle for goals. They might just be one of those teams that scores for fun. So well, it's a fall question to wonder.
In those two nil-nils against HFX and FC Edmonton, six shots on target against Halifax, I think five against Edmonton. So they were getting decent chances. Yeah. And if you have players like Emilio Estevez, who you know can seemingly unlock defenses quite well from the wide spaces, considering how small the pitch is, I mean, sky's the limit, right?
Yeah, I mean, if York 9 were to bring on a, I don't know, pockmarked, burly sort of English striker in the mold of Wayne Rooney. Maybe they had a couple of those shots turn into goals, but I think that's really what they're missing is they've found something in Rodrigo Gattes. I think he's an option, but they're still missing their kind of goal-scoring number nine. And once they find that, if they find that from within or from outside, they're going to be a real contender, I would say.
Do you think the reason why they haven't scored is because the pitch is so small there?
Oh, that's an interesting one. Yeah, potentially. I think it changes the way that you sort of play.
Yeah.
Well, less space out wide, right?
And that just kind of goes with like defenses as well, like playing more compact and not being able to play out, like spread out your man is difficult to do.
Yeah, it definitely changes the way you approach a match. However, I would say that York 9 has shown that even on a full-sized field, their connections are going to be their secret weapon. And I think that's what we'll start to see a lot more of in the coming months.
We're joined now by CanBeAll.ca columnist Stephen Sandor out in Edmonton. Stephen, how are you?
I'm doing not as well as I was a few hours ago.
Well, okay, for context, we are recording this right after the women's match. Yeah, which obviously you're referring to, I'm assuming.
Yeah. I think that's the thing that's the big downer right now for not just me, but the entire country.
Yes, of course. So Canada losing to Sweden 1-0. In France, knocked out at the round of 16. I guess, you know, this is kind of interesting. Some tweets or, you know, some initial reaction, but, you know, what are your initial takeaways from that match and what it means for Canada?
You know, I think obviously a lot of focus is going to be on why Christine Sinclair didn't take the penalty, but that really wasn't so much the bigger issue. The bigger issue was this team just throughout the whole tournament. That was always the fear that everyone had about this team in the friendlies leading up to this tournament, was that they're not a very dynamic attacking force. Despite the talent that they have up front, this is a team that is very pedestrian when they get the ball in the final third and kind of do a lot of hit and hoping rather than making passes. And what really amazed me is if you look at the tape of this game and you look at some of the attacks, how many of the other players other than the ball carrier are simply standing around? They aren't moving their feet away from the ball. They're not trying to get the Swedish defenders to move their feet. And they made that game very easy for the Swedish defenders. You got to move off the ball. You've got to make defenders make decisions. And the Canadian team, there's a lot of players standing at the top of the box. A winger brings the ball in, whether it was Chapman or when Becky went out on the wing, or if it was Ashley Lawrence at times. And there wasn't a lot of moving feet. There wasn't a lot of trying to find gaps. There wasn't a lot of trying to break the Swedish line. And when you're playing with your back to the goal with more than one player and just simply standing and waiting for the ball, you're not going to score a lot. And I think this gets back to just a lot of this mentality that Canada was exceptionally slow in the final third. And this is it's not just about talent. It's about the will to get forward, and it's about the system going forward. And I just didn't see a lot of movement. And so I think Canada, obviously the VAR gods came in and got Canada a penalty. And, you know, and I was joking during the game that, you know, we are going to see VAR become self-aware and it will become Skynet. But it's not right at this moment. Canada got the good end of a couple of VAR decisions, and still that didn't help them. So this is a team that this is a program that really needs to examine tactically what they do going forward, because in the final third, this is a team that looks like it has no ideas.
Well, in 11 shots for Canada, in just the one on target, which was the penalty, I believe. They would have to be on what I'm seeing here. But let's get to that penalty. As you mentioned, there was some discussion after that Christine Sinclair told Becky or said that Becky should take it. And then obviously the save. So, I mean, what are your initial takeaways from that? Obviously, it's pretty easy to say Sinclair should have taken it, but, you know, it's in the past, right?
Yeah, I think in the long run, it gives the fans a kind of a focal point. Obviously, gives us a focal point. We're talking about it, obviously. You know, Janine Becky, she picks a good spot. I mean, the keeper gets the
penalty
right
wasn't
way.
Bad, right?
It wasn't bad, but it wasn't perfect because I think it's hit hip high, right? And every coach tells you that you can't hip high is the deadliest height because if a keeper is diving, that's where they're outstretched. You want to go underneath or up top. So the height wasn't great. The placement in terms of being just inside the post was pretty good. But it wasn't a perfect penalty, but not a lot of players hit perfect penalties. But at the same time, I think it gives us a focal point to discuss, but I think it's a wider discussion about Christine Sinclair and the role on the team. And really, I felt in a lot of times, maybe in other games, they were deferring too much to her. I felt in the games against Cameroon, there were situations where players were passing up shooting opportunities so they could lay the ball off to her, where they, you know, honestly seemed a little bit more concerned about her goal scoring record than they were about the team goals. It was not the case today. But I guess that, you know, the players decide that they'll say who's feeling good, who's feeling it. I think in the end we can live with that decision. I mean, Janine Becky, I feel terrible for her. She's going to have to deal with that for at least 2, probably 4 years in terms of hearing about that and knowing about that. And a lot of people already using the comparisons online to the decision for Gretzky not to take a penalty shot in the 98 Olympics. So I think
very Canadian.
It's very Canadian, but I you know, the analogy is there. And you feel bad for the situation, but I hope it doesn't paper over the bigger problem, which was Canada's attack as a whole over this tournament.
I think
Canada had two better European opponents to play against in this tournament and lost both those games.
Well, we didn't see Jordan Huidema in this match either, and that was another talking point that they even brought up on the broadcast. Someone who could maybe offer a little bit more of that. Would that be a player that could possibly, you know, fix what you mentioned about not moving enough off the ball?
Well, I think in the past, didn't we criticize Benito Floro for some of his decisions he made in games that Canada was trailing, where he seemed to bring in defensive midfielders or defenders rather than attackers, and it felt like that was the case today. You know, bringing in Jade Riviere, bringing in Rebecca Quinn. And, you know, I don't know how injured Nichelle Prince was before she came off. She obviously wasn't at 100%. But to leave Jordan Huidema and just the physical capability when you are going direct. They were going direct in the last 15 minutes. So why wouldn't you bring out your biggest, most physical bench player to come out and be in that situation if you're going direct? It kind of doesn't make a lot of sense. And I mean, I think a lot of questions are going to be asked about Kenneth Heiner-Muller's in-game management in this. But my first, you know, attitude to this is if you're going to go direct, if you're going to launch balls in the box, get your biggest target player out there to be the person out there to get onto the end of the ball. And she was, you know, basically not really used a lot at all in this tournament. And I think a lot of questions will ask, well, why was she there?
Well, Sweden through to the quarterfinals, they'll take on Germany. Switching to the men's side in the CONCACAF Gold Cup, we don't know who they're going to face in the quarterfinals just yet. But coming out of, I guess, a successful group stage, right? A 7-0 win to cap it off against Cuba. But I really want to talk about that Mexico game and how they approached it. You wrote some good stuff on campiel.ca about it. You know, played five at the back to start, but then once they switched up to that 4-3-3 with Davies as left back, they played pretty well against Mexico.
Yeah, I think that when you look back now at the three games, I think we see that John Herdman looked at that as Mexico was a throwaway game, that he knew he needed the results against the two lesser ranked Caribbean nations, and to get those, to get the team rolling. And the goal was always to finish 2-1 or maybe get something against Mexico. But I think more importantly, knowing that Mexico stays on your side of the bracket, that you will, no matter who finishes first, second, you might face each other again.
Yeah. So if Canada moves
not,
on from
not
the...
to overplay your hand, not to overplay your hand in that first preliminary game. I just got the feeling that if they didn't want to show Mexico all that much. I don't think they wanted to show Mexico how they really want to play. I don't think they wanted to give Mexico an idea of really what Canada's about yet. And I think a lot of that game, there's a lot of gamesmanship that went on in the selecting of that roster, of putting what I thought was a very experimental formation and lineup out there. and I think we all thought of it. I think I wrote that it felt like the names were picked out of a hat. But I think that there was a method to the madness. I think he felt not yet. It's not time to pull the curtain off what I really want to show Mexico yet. You don't want to give them time to adjust. You don't want to give them time to scout you. You know the depth of their talent. So I think you want to, when you're ready to take the shot at them, you know, and, you know, history's proven this right. The teams have kind of come out and done this in tournaments where they have to face a team more than once. And maybe the first time, especially if the other team's more favored, you know, I would use an example, but I think anyone who knows me is going to, like, groan. But, yeah, let's say 1954 World Cup. You know, West Germany came out and got slaughtered by Hungary the first game, but didn't play anything like they were going to play in the final, and then won the World Cup, and, you know, one of the bigger upsets in soccer history. But I think that was the case. I think you take that page out of the book and not really show your hand in the early rounds if you know you're going to face a team later, especially if you're comfortable that you know you're going to go through.
Yeah, so Canada, if they move on to the semifinals past this, they'll play the winner of Mexico and the runner-up for Group B. So again, they could face them before the finals. Okay, quickly, Jonathan David, obviously much talked about goal-scoring record with Canada. Are you buying into it, considering, you know, the quality of goals that we saw against Cuba?
I absolutely have bought into it. I think Jonathan David is a very special player, and I've mentioned this, and I mentioned this in my column on Monday, that some of his goals are tap-ins, you know, that you look on the highlight package, you don't watch the whole game, and you think, oh, well, he's just wide open in front of the net, he's just taking a pass. But it's exactly what we didn't see from the women's team, what I was talking about. It's the movement off the ball. It's the fact how he can find dead spots in teams' back lines, how he can find dead spots in the box, how he runs off the ball to get into those really good positions. When the ball's turned over, he knows where to go, where to make that run. And yeah, the finishes look easy because he puts himself in such good positions all the time. He has, for someone his age, his soccer IQ is just so far ahead. And I've been so impressed with him. We will see against bigger opposition.
Yes.
But I've so far, he's passed every test with flying colors. I mean, again, just his ability to stretch defenses and make them worry and make them run. And again, he puts them – a lot of times we laugh in soccer and say, oh, it's a tap-in. But you've got to get into those positions. You have to create those holes in that space for yourself where you've pulled the defense apart and create an open chance for yourself. It's not an accident that seems to happen over and over for this guy. It's because he works exceptionally hard and he sees the field and he sees the back line so very, very well.
Jonathan David and Canada will take on possibly some bigger opposition, maybe playing Costa Rica or Haiti. And we'll learn who that will be later tonight while we're recording here. Stephen, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Now looking ahead to a very busy weekend or very busy week in the CPL, the final week of the spring season leading into the Canada Day matches. But first, we'll start with the midweek, York 9 hosting Cavalry FC in a big game.
Yeah, it's the traveling horsemen of Cavalry taking on those city slickers from York. Does York region really count as a city, though?
Oh, yes.
I guess so. Then it is kind of city versus country, which actually, before we get into this game, we're all in agreement here that like rap is better than country music, right?
Yes. 100%.
Okay, good.
Well, I don't think so.
Oh, no. Oh,
I think country music's good. You ever listen to Gordon Lightfoot? It doesn't really count as country, but you know.
That bluegrass festival.
Yeah, Blue Rodeo, you know. Oh, love that stuff.
Okay, how about we just agree to disagree and we'll just listen to Old Town Road or whatever that song
is. Oh, yeah.
That's
like more country than anything to me. Also, Old Town Road is great.
Yeah, also Best of Both Worlds was the hit single by Miley Cyrus, the daughter of Billy Ray Cyrus. So
wow, the connections here.
The connections run deep. Anyways,
let's
get into some York 9 versus Cavalry FC. This is a big one for Cavalry because they are looking for a win. 3 points will do it, as Holly said earlier. And I think York 9 will really want to play spoilers. It's been a role they've embraced throughout the year. They defy expectations. They defied expectations in the Canadian Championship and in that inaugural match, and now they have a chance to throw a wrench into Tommy Wheeler Jr.'s plans as well. So it's it's going to be a game that I think will be closer than most people give a lot of credit for.
Yeah, that's interesting. I personally think that Cavalry is going to win this game. But Armin, I think you were maybe thinking York might take this one.
I think it'll be like close. I think the big area that Cavalry exploited in the early parts of York 9 was their inability to really connect with one another. Now that that's no longer a case, you're trying to win a midfield battle against a team that has five really good midfielders on a narrow field. So yeah, that's a task. That's a task and a half.
Well, in York 9, even though they haven't scored in the last couple of games, they haven't conceded for even longer than that.
Yeah, exactly.
Luca Gasparato, Daniel Gogarty, those guys are coming into to some kind of form.
Plus Nathan Ingham, who's been like the goalkeeper of the year.
It's very true. But it's tough because when I watched that Cavalry Forge game, and the way that Nico Pasquati was being targeted was crazy because, yeah, you know, he is their danger man. And I'm wondering, we already talked about it earlier in the show about the small pitch, but you know, if you're going to play Nico Pasquati out on the wing, you know, this fast, you know, raging bull type winger, how does he fit into a field like that with, as you mentioned, Armin, the five midfielders?
Yeah, I don't think Abzi is as capable as Azawuwa in handling Pasquati.
That's a good take. Yeah, I mean, like, it's one of those situations where Abzi is just way more forward-looking than Awuwa. Awuwa is capable of tracking back a little better. So, yeah, it's like, it's going to be interesting to see it because of the fact that Pasquati is such an important part of their team. But, I mean, you got to imagine with Dechara back that you can neutralize Camargo a little bit and then... Really, do you start Malanga and Jordan Brown up top to really force the issue? There's ways of disrupting York, but it's just a matter of how much does Tom Ioana overwhelm with the risk of potentially getting scored on?
Yeah, I'm curious about that too. I would probably want to see Brown and Malanga play because it gives you a little bit more in the air. And maybe if you're having trouble penetrating, you can just try to flick balls in and see where you can go. That's what happened when you think about it in some of the early games. But also in the first game these two teams played against each other in Cavalry's first ever game, 2-1, Cavalry won that one. Two headed goals,
yep,
in the Snowfest in Calgary. But that, you know, they kind of got something similar there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a battle. It's not going to be easy for either team. And the other thing that we're not considering here is, in the end of the day, York 9 has nothing really to play for, and Cavalry has a lot of pressure on them not to take everything down to Canada Day, which is going to be like make or break time. So Forge is also playing on Wednesday. If they wrap things up, then, I mean, really, you're putting a ton of pressure on yourself and on Canada Day when you know everybody's like dreaming of barbecues. So,
well, Forge is playing in Edmonton on Wednesday. And again, as we mentioned, that is a must win. They need to win that to at least overtake Cavalry or at least tie them if they do end up just taking one point. One really interesting thing to keep in mind for Wednesday is Cavalry and Edmonton are kicking off at 7 p.m. Eastern time. And then Forge and FC Edmonton are kicking off 2 hours later. So Forge could be hitting the pitch if Cavalry won, with nothing to play for,
yeah,
in theory.
Or if they lose, then Forge knows this is it. This is our chance. I mean, they already know that this is the only thing they got to win anyways, but
it's just interesting.
Yeah,
though,
it's fascinating how it's staggered out like that. Beginning of the season, I don't know. I thought the spring would have been wrapped up by now. So the fact that it's going down to the wire is really fascinating to me.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting on Wednesday to see how Forge matches up against FC Edmonton. Because, you know, we saw the way that they played against Pacific, going to that 4-4-2. They played Soria and Marcelin together in the midfield, two older, maybe not as fast central midfielders. And I'm curious to see how Forge might be able to work around them if they go back to that 4-4-2.
Well, you're a United fan, so you know all about old, ineffective No, I'm sorry.
Well, because Soria and Marcelin have that experience, you'd have to assume that they would be able to handle, you know, the pace of Forge. If they were putting out a younger midfielder, then you'd have to be a little bit worried about that. But
yeah,
I think they should be pretty confident in what they have.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, they do have a lot of experience in that middle of the park. I mean, we saw it with Canada too. You know, Atiba Hutchinson can play anywhere really, but if he has to play defensive midfield, even at his age, he's capable of doing it, and he's capable of playing against some of the better players in this region. So there is definitely an element of experience when it comes to it. The other thing I think is that Edmonton is probably riding a high right now and are feeling pretty good about themselves, especially after like a 6-game slump, I don't think they're really interested in entertaining the possibility of regressing. They're going to want to build on that, and you know Paulus is going to try to force it. So if it's a battle over 90 minutes, even if it is meaningless, they're going to want to ride that wave.
And then after those two very big games on Wednesday, we're going to get into Canada Day games.
Oh, Canada.
Yeah, 3 back-to-back-to-back. We've got FC Edmonton taking on Halifax, Valor taking on York 9 and Pacific and Calgary there. Valor hosting at Winnipeg. That should be a nice day out there in at IG Field.
Well, it better be, because Louis Bélanger is tired of losing. That's what he said after the last one.
There's some interesting quotes after that one.
4 losses in a row, and he says, I'm sick of talking about it. He's like, I don't want to talk about possession anymore. Possession-based team, blah, blah, blah. He's like, he was over it, and rightfully so. I think I wrote about it in the breakdown this week, but possession is a stat that, especially in the early years of MLS, for example, people paid a lot of attention to it, because for people entering this sport for the first time, they see the possession stat and go, well, if one team had 60% of possession and the other team had 40, then the team with 60% possession should have won because they had more possession.
And this came with tiki-taka and Barcelona and everything.
So this was around an era where possession was the backbone of essentially the most dominant teams in the world. But I think soccer in general has moved on. And I also think that that was an outlier and not necessarily a sign of like a constant trend. Possession is only meaningful as a narrative if it's in the extremes. So if you have a team with 80% possession and then the other team with only 20% possession beats you 4-1 or whatever, that's a narrative. That's like, you had so much of the ball. What did you do wrong here? But when the margin's like 60-40, 57-43, like, that's, what does that mean really? It means that one team had like, what, 30-40 extra touches? Like, it's not a huge indication of, I think, success on the field. And that's what Bélanger was saying, was possession alone is not going to win us games. We actually have to start winning games. We have to see these things through over 90 minutes. And I mean, it's a frustration that I think some of his teammates probably share, but it's also a fair assessment of their team. I mean, the problem, or I guess the circumstance around it, is Rob Gale has a long-term vision, just like every coach of every CPL team. And it becomes a case of, in implementing your long-term vision, what are you willing to sacrifice? So in the case of Valor, they're probably sacrificing some immediate results in order to build this like free-flowing, attacking, on-the-ground sort of football. But at the same time, that can be very frustrating for players, especially for guys like Louis Bélanger, who are used to being able to balance those things. So there's some growing pains, and I think that's what he's expressing.
Well, and it's interesting because, for one, Gale will mention in post-match interviews that, you know, oh, we got X amount of possession. That's good, because that's his goal as a coach, is to keep the ball and play attractive football. But the other thing that he's mentioned, which is a great point, that I think a lot of people don't really understand, is by playing this type of football, you can increase the value of these players and make these players, you know, improve them, especially moving forward, especially, you know, being comfortable on the ball in a professional environment. You know, that's huge for any kind of player, right?
It's kind of like a balancing act, because sometimes, you know, you focus on possession, but then other times you got to give that up and you got to win. So it's tough, but you got to trust the process.
Trust the process.
Very cliche, but
it's not cliche though. There is a truth in it, I think. It's that idea that we sacrifice in the short term for the betterment in our long term. And really, every team in the CPL is playing the long game, because they've only played like 10 games.
Speaking of that, this is our last episode in the spring season before it rolls over into the fall, and we have a spring champion. So I wanted to pose the question, how's this final week going to shape up? Is Calvary going to win it, or is Forge going to win it?
Well, barring any sort of hidden immunity idol that grants like 30 extra points.
There it is.
It won't be York 9. It won't be Edmonton. Won't be any of those guys. But I think it's Calgary. I think they'll find a win in their next two.
And yeah.
I hope it goes to Canada Day, because that would be awesome. So I would love to see a York 9 win on Wednesday, just to make it super interesting, along with a Forge win. But then I think they take it on Saturday.
What do you think, Holly?
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree with Armin, just because Calvary do have 2 games left to play. It's kind of more in their favor So I would have to go the same way.
Yeah, and even two draws would do it. But they're not going to get it. Ooh. Forge is going to win it. Yeah, Calvary's going to go 0-2.
So you see the come-from-behind Forge success on the final day.
Could you imagine?
Wow. Well, it would be incredible. It would be a nice little ending. And then it would also give credence to the idea that the spring sprint is never really over until it's finished.
On that note, I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Let's wait till Canada Day, everybody. Enjoy your barbecues.
Okay, see you after July 1st.